Hey, Richard, good morning. Oh, well, good morning. Good afternoon.
And good evening.
Yeah, that too.
Okay, do you are you comfortable with going on with the weather up there? Or?
Yeah, you know, I've been through worse.
Okay.
You live in Florida, don't you, Don?
No, South Carolina.
Oh, it's is it Ray that lives in Florida?
Yeah, okay. Raised in Florida.
South Carolina is pretty good too. I mean, I was just talking about the hurricanes and whatnot in that area. South Carolina would definitely qualify for Hurricane Alley.
Only on the coast.
Yeah.
If weather gets bad over there for you, let us know and we can pick up at a later date. That won't be a problem.
That's fine. I'm indoors.
Because, well, we tried to interview Sunday night, and we lost power completely over here. So, it can happen.
This is Last One Out, and you're listening to the Comic Pop Library.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of Comic Pop Visits, brought to you by Comic Pop Library. I'm Richard, along with
Lenny.
And today we are visiting with Don Horan. He is the author of Slugline that we reviewed recently on the podcast. And Don, we welcome you to the show and appreciate you coming on.
Hey, thank you, guys.
We also know Don through way of our Star Trek connections down south in Oklahoma City at Starbase Studios, so we might dive into a little bit of Star Trek at the end of the episode, because he's working on a project, too, that he might want to discuss with us, but for now, we're going to concentrate on his novel.
It's all about the slug line.
Yes.
Which, like Richard, that was something that I had never heard of before reading your book, and I'm now very fascinated. So this is a real practice, or is this something that you just fancifully created?
Well, I wish I could take credit for it.
But they really do it.
I was surprised as the rest of the world to see that such a thing went on. It was in the late 90s or something. I had the chance to visit my brother down in the suburbs of Washington. He's retired Air Force, but he had a contractor job at the Pentagon. Okay. And when we left his house, it was just two of us in his car. And he said, we have to pick up a slug. And I really didn't know what that meant. And he said, you'll see. So, fine, I'll see. So, we got off an exit right before the high-occupancy vehicle lane started. I-95 is a treacherous commute for passenger cars because you're trapped among all the tractor-trailers. But if you're lucky enough, in Washington in the early 90s, they implemented HOV lanes. And it was very strictly enforced, and you had to have three heads in the car. So, we were just... two guys driving, and he said, we have to get off here and go into this parking lot that people drive to, leave their car, get out of their car, and go stand on a line to one of maybe a half dozen locations in downtown D.C. where they would then climb into a car, and you'd instantly become three, and you could all go in the HOV lane.
Brilliant.
I was stunned by this. I mean, I just couldn't believe how people would get into strangers' cars. It's not carpooling, where you leave with the same group of neighbors and come home with the same group of neighbors.
Sure.
You just stand on a line, and a car with either one or two people in it pull up and say, I need one or I need two. There'd be a line for the Pentagon, a line for Pentagon City, a line for Crystal City, a line for 14th Street, wherever you were going.
Sure.
Huh. And you would, and on the first occasion I saw this, a woman just gets right in the back seat, says good morning, and goes right on a BlackBerry. And I couldn't get over this. And there's a little discomfiture in the beginning. You don't know if you're supposed to turn around and make conversation and everything else. But my brother made it clear. No, that a slug is just a body. That's all it is. It's a body, nameless, faceless. Gets in your car. You go in the HOV lane. They get out where they what their destination was, and you're already inside the city. And you take a 40-minute, take a commute that would be an hour and 10, you chop it down to 35 minutes. So, you know, I looked at this process and I said, wow, what a great opportunity for a serial killer. You know, I mean, I read a whole lot of books, and I was a big Alex Cross fan from James Patterson books, and I was like, wow, you know, you don't even have to drag them into the van. They get in by themselves.
Well, I was going to say, if you're in a different part of town and a lady steps into your car off the street, it might be something else. Where's the nearest hotel?
Well, I think it was really original how you incorporated the practice into your story, and it intrigued me immediately whenever I read up what, you know, on your book. It kind of explains right away what a slug line is, and as soon as I had read that and knew that it had something to do with terrorism because of the first line, I was like, oh yeah, this is going to get good fast. And of course it did. But it was just, yeah, a mundane practice that is only probably there and maybe a few other places in the world even considered or conceived of. I've never heard of. Richard's never heard of it.
The only thing we have close that I can think of is in Pueblo, and over there in Colorado. We go there and they have those mass parking lots where people will carpool together. They'll just go to the parking lots and then they'll get into one car and go. But usually it's the same people, though.
Yeah,
not
but,
different people.
I mean, this is that's more like but organized you know, hitchhiking.
Yeah, exactly.
True.
But you know those people. See, this is something. I've been to Europe, and they hitchhike very differently in Europe. You go to a gas station, you hold up a sign, and to the destination city, wherever you're going. And so a person looks at you, they look at your sign, and they decide whether they want to stop up by where you're standing and pick you up at the fueling station so that you're not out on the road, you're not in the way, and people know right away what you want. You know, it's while they're stopping that they can, you know, so, and that's how everybody does it there. And it's very, we got rides very quickly whenever we wanted to do that. And that's something, you know, but they told me there, well, this would never work in the United States because people would get killed.
Well, you know, the other side of it is that you've got to do it on the way home or you get stranded in town.
Yeah, now, that's
what developed among the slug line users is a high etiquette of you never strand somebody. Even if the HOV lanes turn off at 7 p.m., you always swing by to see if there's a straggler, some guy who got delayed at work, whose car is down in Springfield, you know, and he needs a ride. You go by the, if you're going home to Springfield, you would slide by the Springfield line and see if there's anybody left. So the etiquette was a big part of it. You know, do I bring a cup of coffee in your car? Well, I don't know. If the driver permits it, sure. If not, too bad.
Huh.
But there was always the driver made all the calls. And, you know, again, what really struck me was how casually this woman got in a car with two male strangers.
Yeah.
it didn't even look up from her BlackBerry after she said good morning.
Sounds like an adult movie.
We drove into Crystal City and she got off and we parked and she got a free commute. I mean, it's economically as much as it is a time saver. You know, driving and parking in Washington, D.C. is a hefty ticket. So a lot of people just did it, you know, just to save money. There were the parking lots themselves are, sure, they're private property, but they're usually abandoned retail shopping centers, big furniture stores that closed. Or back then, there was just a tremendous amount of vacant Kmarts and builder squares that had parking for 400 cars. And everybody would just leave their car and fully expect to be dropped back at that car by somebody they'd never met later on that day.
And not the person that took them to town. There's no accountability from the actual driver that took you into town.
None.
It's just whoever happened to come back by the line.
But it's a 35-minute ride instead of an hour 10 behind a tractor trailer. So, you know, everybody had a trade-off.
Yeah.
With you being in security, was that where you kind of gleaned where, hey, this is a little bit of a risk, and to your knowledge, are they trying to secure this a little better?
I flew a lot in business. I traveled by air a lot, and I always picked up airport books. I was a big fan of, you know, Patterson, and I'd like the John Sanford Prey books. Prior to that, it was the Ken Follett political thrillers, all that kind of stuff. And my mind always went in that direction because I used to write a lot of episodic TV scripts for my own enjoyment. I mean, you mentioned Ray Tessie earlier. He and I went to high school together. We wrote scripts together for just about every single TV show that was ever on. and we carried that forward and continued to write, what we would consider movies of the week kind of stuff, or just episodes of television shows we were very fond of that, we never saw. Wouldn't it be great if, all the TV shows back then had the same script formats. There was always the episode where the star went blind. There was always the episode where the star's sister got kidnapped. There was always the episode, it was all so formulaic. But, we were fans of a lot of action TV shows back when there were no VCRs. You had to be in front of the TV when they showed it, or you missed it.
No, I don't remember those days.
Over time, I'm not at all abashed to say that, Star Trek was, it was on six nights a week in New York City on WPIX-TV, and the next day we'd go to high school and talk about the episode from the night before. Yeah, it's geeky and everything else, but when you go to an all-boys Catholic high school, there's not much else to talk about. But, it was almost like a painstaking process in explaining Slugline in the first two chapters. You didn't want to bash the reader over the head with, five different explanations of it. But at the same time, you had to really sell it that this thing exists and that it's primarily used by government employees, predominantly military personnel. And, once I got off the James Patterson idea of a serial killer, and, sadly, this is post 9/11, I started to think about a process, wouldn't that be a great opportunity for terrorists to grab up military people? I mean, I would look up and down these slug lines, three quarters of the people are in uniform, they all have a briefcase, they all have a laptop. You're talking high-value targets. Plus, nobody's going to find out about it till after you have them.
True.
If they do at all.
Yeah, you would make a very evil terrorist, sir.
part of me said, geez, I'd hate to put this idea out there. Believe me, there was a conscience wrestling with that. Nobody knew which direction domestic terrorism was going to go. Right after 9/11, they had the anthrax scare in Washington. Then a few years later, you had the sniper in Washington. I tried to blend, newsworthy fact and with, a little bit of fiction around it. I built some of the characters around real life events. And just to bring some gravitas to the story, and plus I had to make sure that while I was writing it, there were enough positives in the characters that it wasn't so just completely dark and bad.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit of a balancing act there. The other thing I wanted to do was go away from the trend of mystery writers that whenever there was a government agency involved, it was always incompetent or corrupt, or there was some weasel in the mix that was trying to get ahead, who would subvert the investigation for his own personal gain. I hated all that. It became so trite and so predictable. I actually thought it would be novel to have the government function properly, and people in positions being competent and dedicated and willing to take risks to pursue something worthwhile.
Now you say that everything's working smoothly, and it does. I think that they are a very competent group of characters, very realistic, but that you do have a wild card in the mix, and I thought it was really my favorite character. I really have to bring this up now. I'm sorry. I can't wait any longer. This guy needs his own series. He's cool.
I'll echo that. I know who he's going to say without even knowing.
And, Zach Tanner is just, man, he's just a hell of a guy. I want to shake his hand. I feel like he's real. And, it was really fun to kind of, see him basically kind of having to go on his own in a way, to get things done on his timetable, to make sure that his girl and the other hostages aren't harmed. But then also that elevated, I don't want to give everything away because there's a great, great plot twist in the end that I almost don't want to mention anything about it. It's brilliant, sir. The way that this is aimed at a kind of a bigger picture, and you don't really see it coming because you get so sucked into Henry Wallace and Marla Perrin and Jermaine and all, you know, even Miguel. All of their personal lives, and you're so, as a reader, you're so worried about them. You're like, oh my God, this is going to go badly, and you know, you're really kind of on the edge of your seat for them. But then there's something behind, these terrorists have something darker in mind. So I really think that that's you know, without giving away too much of your ending, I think that that was very very clever twist, and definitely made it. It elevated it to the next level where, you know, it wasn't just, it wasn't predictable at all. And you're right, the government was well thought out, functioned well, and it kind of was like a jigsaw puzzle on a timer. You know, like they didn't have an extra minute to do any of this. So once they knew what was cracking, you know, and every player, had they not had that as much in stake and worked as hard as they did, especially Del Mabry and Zach Tanner, yeah, then this, you know, this whole plot goes up, you know, goes up. They basically just barely in the nick of time, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it's brilliant. Well, I love
you know,
it.
I always envisioned the ending, you know, without ever having a method of getting there. You know, you always envision, you know, sure, Bruce Willis running across the top of a rooftop with, you know, the guy with the detonator running one way and the guy with the girl running the other way, and what's Bruce Willis going to do? You know, yeah, you always think of those kinds of things. It didn't quite culminate that way, but still, it was in my mind, I wanted it all to come together in at least a literary crescendo where, you know, the real odd thing about this book is once I got involved in all the hostages and the trials and tribulations and everything else, that evolved because I really didn't know how to crack this case. And in a lot of ways, this was the perfect crime because the crime had concluded by the time the authorities learned of it. So it was a real conundrum for me as a writer. I'm talking about, I kid you not, a six-year conundrum.
Yeah.
On how to...
I feel you on those kind of problems, sir.
Yeah, I mean, on how to crack this perfect crime without resorting to, you know, a blunder so inconsistent with the terrorist planning, you know, the blunder would have been bad. You know, I was down to waking up and it's all a dream kind of thing, you know. By just pounding away, I was able to develop three separate lines by three divergent resource people on how they could all meet together. Everybody doing their job. That was the point. I was living up in Boston at the time of the resurgence of the New England Patriots, and this was this Bill Belichick thing. Do your job. Do your job. And I kept having that mantra for the government agency. You know, forget what the political pressure is. Forget what the, you know, career pressures are. Just do your job. And sure enough, I was able to develop three different lines of rescue for three different entities. And, you know, fortunately for me, it all came together at the end in a very plausible way. And again, I'm dedicated to credibility in a story. I don't like authors who reach. I don't like authors who take the easy way out. As I continued toward trying to figure out an ending, all I did was paint myself in a different corner. I put the hostages in separate locations. I did all these things to thwart a let alone a rescue detection. You know, I didn't know enough about computers at the time to wonder if there was a method of tracing these safe houses through the website communication that happened, the pirated website communications. Mm-hmm. You know, I blended in the Washington, D.C. area sniper story from the early 2000s in order to establish Del Mayberry's ability to react quickly and leverage different contacts that were forged as a result of that. I think there were 42 different law enforcement agencies involved in the sniper case, but having him have a history with that, where he could leverage those resources, and it all moved along on a good time frame. Meanwhile, your hero Zach Tanner's following his own way. There was a point where Zach and Dell together learned of the second safe house, and as a writer, I was like, well, does Zach share this with Dell, or doesn't he? The way it all worked out, it did. And I try to make the lead terrorist, Saeed, very, very clever, very resourceful, very cold-blooded. I thought his dialogue with Mahler, especially when she was in captivity, was almost chilling, the way he tried to play her. And sure enough, the darkest part of her fears were came to pass in a way that she had to perhaps rise above what she thought her own capabilities were.
And I love that, because you were going for realism, but it was in very much way in a heroic kind of adventure, and I especially on her part. Like, I thought that she really kind of broke out of the mold and didn't just play the victim with her necklace and attack. I think it was Mir Hanjour. Am I saying that right? Who was attacking her? Who she fought back?
Well, it was one of his thugs.
Oh, okay, one of his thugs. That's right. He was.
The chief interrogator. He turned her over to one of his thugs. Mm-hmm.
Basically. We'll go ahead and say it.
Well after it was written, and I was reading it, I realized there was a little Princess Leia Jabba the Hutt thing went on there.
Yeah.
And at the time I was writing it, I never recognized it, but in hindsight, I'm like, geez, that's an awful lot. Like that.
Sound familiar? No, I didn't think of that either. No, but that is really clever.
Didn't go there, but okay. But with Saeed and Mir, you kind of had that dichotomy where you made Mir the savage, the brute, the one that you just hated, but Saeed, the reader could respect him because he was so diabolical. And a lot of times the author doesn't necessarily do that. And at times you're almost thinking, like, he could have been a decent guy at one point.
That's exactly how I felt about Saeed. Yeah. I felt like Saeed, had he not been raised exactly how he was, he could have been a totally good guy that I could have had a barbecue with, totally ate pork with. But seriously, the characters, the differentiation between the two is pretty amazing. And Saeed especially, I think he will, from readers, pull a lot of sympathy. Not necessarily, and it's hard because, you're living in post 9/11 America, where even the not so patriotic are pretty patriotic when it comes to people mm-hmm. attacking their country. And, mm-hmm. To have somebody that has had and, wanted to be involved with the 9/11 plot, and I like that part. And,
thought the backstory of Saeed and the, almost a mythology of the fifth cell.
Sure.
That that was a tough write, because you couldn't overreach, because actually nothing happened in real life. But if you could imagine a plot that could have happened, and that's where that drop in chapter 16, the flashback to Saeed's mission on 9/11 and how
it failed. Yeah.
Very understandable how you could have a misstep the way he did.
Well, the thing is Florida's very odd in that I lived in Pensacola for almost 8 years, and it's the only county in Florida. It's several counties, but it's the only part of Florida. It's like all the way over to, I think, almost to Tallahassee. Central Time.
And Mobile, yes.
Yeah, and then the whole rest of the state, like most of the state, is in Eastern Time. So if you're coming from Jacksonville, it's like a 0-hour flight because the time it takes... Oh no! If you're going to Jacksonville, it's a 0-hour flight. That's what it is.
And if you're in the country, learning the language, learning the geography. If you're only in the country a year,
sure,
it's easy to see how they could not possibly perceive that.
And such a smart person. I mean, you could see how it would destroy his ego. I mean, I could almost see, like, oh my God, you got to feel like the biggest yutz in all of Al Jazeera. I mean, like, you're the guy that they're all making fun of on Al Jazeera and everything. This schlep over here who, they probably wouldn't use that word. But, you know. Well,
yeah, I would just think what Jimmy Kimmel would do to him.
Right? He would totally roast him, of course, yeah. That, you know, so, I mean, that to have that burn on you, and you can tell that he is tainted. I mean, he appears to be a nice guy, especially when he deals with Marla. On the surface, very nice guy. Deep down, way worse than Mir Hanjour, because he doesn't just want to hurt you physically. He wants to hurt everybody really bad, as in the worst possible way.
Even his own people.
Exactly. I mean, he doesn't care about anyone. He just wants...
Sociopath.
Yeah, exactly.
Sociopath.
Sure.
You know, he calls over to the other safe house. He doesn't get an answer. I mean, what an extreme response. You know, he's just...
I don't want to say what happens, but I also have to compliment one more thing specifically. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but sorry. So in the very modern way, there's almost like there's an epilogue, and it's almost like how in modern movies you have a very exciting ending, and then the credits roll, and you calm down, and then all of a sudden the lights come back up, and there's one more little scene, and I feel like that's what you did with the epilogue. And I really enjoy that scene. I don't want to give away that scene either, but it's just, you know, I'm like, okay, there it is. Okay, that's the final punch.
That's the TV culture I grew up in.
Sure.
You know, I grew up in that TV culture where, you know, it's I'm a Quinn Martin guy. You know, a Quinn Martin show always had an epilogue. And it's like, you know, I wonder what happened to these people, and you tell them. You know, I think there's enough surviving characters to build something else off of, but you know, at the end of the day, I tried to complicate the first the detection and then second the resolution. That I'm not kidding you, it took 6 years to figure out how to do it, but you know, at the end of the day, I was very pleased with the way it came out. Of course, the kidnapping and the hostage situation was only a diversion plot in the first place. You know, the whole thrust of it was he wanted his second shot at what he missed on 9/11. He wanted that second shot, and he tried to orchestrate it. You know, when the president travels, everything's so laid out in advance that if you could have a situation that interrupted that whole thing and caused a non-planned diversion to those travel plans on your schedule, and you know, predict what the outcome would be, you would be in a wonderful position. And I'll tell you what woke me up to that again was a trip to Washington, D.C. And I forget what year it was, but it was the year that President Reagan died, and they were flying his body back to Washington on Air Force One. And I was astounded going into Andrews Air Force Base how low to the ground that plane flew. I mean, I think Tom Brady could hit it with a football. It wasn't full of air, but you know, that plane was low, and it struck me that if somebody knew in advance, they could do some damage. So I try to make, you know, A cause B, and there's a lot of great episodes or TV shows that have done that better than I did, that's for sure. I thought the show Homeland on Showtime did a fabulous job of A causing B when they had the sniper miss the vice president to bring everybody into the safe room, where then you would get them all with the suicide vest, you know, where otherwise, unless you cause something to get them all in a small place, you wouldn't get half of them. So I like that kind of A is the central plot, and but the causation gives you an opportunity you would never would have. So, you know, that's really what I was shooting for.
Were you in the military to get all this info, or are you just a history buff to have the information?
No, I hate to sound like Chauncey Gardner from being there, but everything I've learned, I learned from watching TV. I don't mean to say that flippantly. It's honest to God. Action, adventure, you know, watching stuff. Yeah, I knew enough of what a reader would expect. Now, I have no idea whether this is the way it really goes down. I don't know what a reader or a viewer would expect and buy into and say, yeah, that's probably right.
But yeah,
that's
you knew
what they do.
Yeah, but you knew what we'd want to hear, and you gave it to us, and it totally worked.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what they do. For all I know, they'd say, well, they're gone. Next.
So your research must have been really well, because the slug line aspect describing that and the terrorist aspect describing all that, I mean, that sounded like you really did your research then when you were putting this together.
I did most of my research online, especially when I tried to interweave real terrorist plots from the late 90s. I wanted to pull characters. I wanted to pull events. I wanted to,
do some major name dropping.
Yeah, name dropping big. I mean, but all those things happened. And I think to build a fictional story around the things that happened in order to present a believable biography of somebody is fine.
Okay. With Zach, I know we kind of talked about him, but he never really answered us. Are you encouraged in possibly making a second novel with him as the lead?
I think he is. I think what makes it... the funny thing, I think his motivation is all about Marla, and okay. I don't know if he would be as appealing if she wasn't in it, nor could I really truly think that romance would survive more than, a nice winter in the mountains. She's got a career, he's got a career, they're, disparate agencies. That was just a hot spot of, a great romance that flared up great. But what I liked about him is that he really knew the enemy, and he felt that the United States government didn't know the enemy, and he needed to listen to what they were going to do, listen to their approach, and say, well, to himself, that's not going to work. I got to go.
Well, you can almost see him as a quote-unquote consultant for an agency, and he would be the lead and have fun with that a little bit, whether it be U.S. Yeah, or different.
You should write fan fiction for Don.
No, I think he's a great character. So, he has a lot of great attributes, but I think he's a passionate guy. I don't think he's a super spy. I just think he works within the confines of, his agency. But, he's ruthless when he needs to be.
Right, and that's what appealed to me, was because he wasn't a superhero aspect. He knew his stuff, and it's like you said earlier, it's like, he's not going to go out and shoot him up, bang, bang. He's going to be there to actually do the real life stuff. He's a real hero, and if he needs to, he can go out and do what needs to be done, but he's not going to do it like a action hero would per se, and that's what I enjoyed about him. He was like a true life
that,
person.
The unlikely allegiance or alliance with Dell, who's, when it comes, he's a city detective, but he's got a personal stake. I mean, poor Saeed, who, couldn't get it right on 9/11, winds up picking a couple of people off the line, are just the wrong people to pick.
He picked up the wrong people. I was going to say, all of this hinges on Saeed's extremely bad luck at picking up Marla Perrin and Jermaine
Dyson. The gunny.
Because had he not picked both of those people up and kidnapped them both, then, the plot works together wonderfully like that.
But I tried to demonstrate through the other hostages that, everybody had somebody.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
In a way, they might not have had the tools that Marla had or the tools that Jermaine had in their lives. But, you know, everybody had somebody, even the poor airman, you know, had that girlfriend, Melanie. She was, you know, she went down there and knocked on doors and said, hey, you know, where's Edwin?
And didn't get anywhere with it.
Nope. Didn't get anywhere, but, you know, she was able to go far enough that something bubbled up into Dell's investigation.
Sure. It was the cross-reference that got him involved with the other agencies and eventually led him to Zach Tanner.
And, you know, the poor Major Wallace, God, you know, his wife, you could keep her, no?
Yeah. He didn't really have anybody. It's lucky he was a major and he was important, or they would have never noticed he was missing.
But what he had in his private life was that he was not going to be there to pick up those kids at that airport, and the wife was, you know, bullshit pissed about it.
Yeah, she was pissed.
She was ringing every bell there was.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got somebody, you know, and Mike Swanee, God, what he, you know, they wanted to cut his tongue out six ways from Sunday, but, you know, he was so resilient.
Yeah, him having to do exact prayers, and this is something that you must have had to do a lot of research on, because I felt for him, even him being a Muslim or just coming from a Muslim culture where he was able to fake it, because it was so relentlessly. I mean, was this something that you just kind of made up, or is this actually like how the prayers go? Because I have no clue. So
I researched those prayer sequences.
Yeah, they're very intense. I mean, as a Catholic, I know some intense prayer sequences, but those really do it. You know, those are pretty.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if somebody put a gun to your head and asked you to be an altar boy in Latin, you know, you'd be dead.
Oh. Yeah, it is, you know, whenever you get an independent book like this and you know, you start reading it, and a lot of it, you know, the story's good or whatever, and it, you know, but it's rare, you know, especially with this kind of realistic story, to be so surprised. And for me, of course, I do read a lot of independent books, and I read a lot of Clive Cussler books, and my dad loves Clive Cussler. I'm okay with him. Mostly I've read the books that my dad's given me. Oh, you have to read this book. And I mean, I'm, you know, like I say, I'm okay with it. I like it. It's not my favorite. I feel this is very comparable with him because of the, you know, whether or not it was fact or not, you make it seem like fact as far as all the government stuff and with the terrorism stuff as well. And you know, and it's just, you know, kind of like it's an action adventure in that kind of same style as most of his stuff. But whereas in his stories, the endings they seem very predictable. Like, of course, this is going to happen. Of course this is going to happen. And with this, I really didn't know. And I think one of the reasons I didn't know is because you made it so tediously realistic. And when I say tediously, like, it seemed like this really happened and you were a direct witness of it. You know, it seemed like you worked on it day and night to make it as plausible as possible. And, you know, when it's that realistic and it can still kind of get the adventure ending and, you know, the adventure, you know, kind of, I don't want to say happily ever after, but, you know, it was able to twist and not disappoint me or like say, oh yeah, well they had to do that. So they weren't, you know, but you know, it was able to twist and untwist, if you can kind of understand what
the
I'm saying.
The resolution worked.
I do. And I'm frankly flattered that you know, you could dive so deep and appreciate those little nuggets and those elements. I'm really grateful for you to say that. You know, it was a labor of love for sure, and you know, a word I never heard of before. But what my editor told me was that regardless of whether or not this is what really goes on, the book has verisimilitude. I didn't know that word, but I nodded when she said it.
I've heard it before. Can you tell me what it means so I don't feel foolish?
Just, you know, realistic would have worked. You know, just say realistic. You know, you don't have to... But, you know, what did I know? So I said, oh, thank you. But
she had to pull out that $100 word so you could pay her.
I am sure that somebody in the Defense Intelligence Agency or any of the real agencies that go on there would read this and put it down, because I simply do not have the inside understanding of how things really work. I only have the perception, like every other walking American around, of what you think it is.
Yeah, but you know, NCIS and like shows like this on TV, I mean, if you really look at this, and like especially the ones like Bones, and if you really look at the science of what's going on in their television, there's none. It's not there. The police work, Castle, forget about it. They do no real police work in Castle.
You might moonlighting.
Yeah. It's my favorite show. I love Castle. I love it to death. I don't care that it's totally fake police work. I just love it. But then at the same time, I'm not a police officer. I'm not looking to catch real criminals. I'm looking to be entertained by the zany antics of a fun writer who gets to follow a super hot New York detective. That's great. That's fun. It doesn't have to be realistic. But whenever they can actually kind of, like House is a good example, whether they know what they're talking about or not, make it seem like they do. And I think that's something Hugh Laurie's always been great at in that show, making it seem like he's smarter than everybody else. And that's the thing. When you can make it seem like, yeah, that's definitely how it happens.
Yeah, and I can see what you're saying, because I watched the first year and a half of the show Person of Interest, and then I said, well, this is so far-fetched, I can't stay with it. Then Edward Snowden burst on the scene. Okay, I went right back to watching that show. I went right back to it, because you know something? For all we know, it is the way it goes down. Granted, it's fiction and everything else, but when you hear Snowden's recounting of actually what they do and how they do it, that show wasn't so far off the mark.
Sure.
True.
You know, one thing that, the thing about fact and fiction is, any story, there's 6.5, 7 billion people on the planet. God knows. Everything that can happen will and does in China. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's so many people. Like, I'm sure that some crazy little terrorist has attacked a slug line if they're that vulnerable. If there is any exploitable chance for somebody that's like that and they're there, I'm sure that some of them are. You know, they might have gotten away with it. You know, that's why you haven't heard about it, because it is super easy to kidnap people.
It is. And in the 10 years since I really got onto this and started writing about it, now they used to have a fax number, or they used to put flyers under windshields of cars, but now they have a full-blown website. And they, it's all the graphics and everything else, but you will read where riders report bad conduct by drivers, or drivers report, bad conduct by,
So they have Rotten Tomatoes for slug lines. Great.
Yeah.
What's your driver rating? No.
In the maroon Chevy, man.
That maroon Chevy. You know, that's one of my favorite parts of the story, just for the intensity of it, is where the driver panics and gets out of the slug line, and Del Mayberry is setting right there. It's Del, right, that's setting right there and looks at him and sees them and has no idea who he's looking at, because there, again, are so many people in the world that it's totally plausible.
But they see him.
Yeah.
They see him.
Yeah, and it's just...
And that's what I like about Warren Rogers, is he strikes as a William Holden kind of New York City cop who's like, well, get out there, get out there and wave the flag, see what you can see, that kind of you never know stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the whole thing hinged on that at all, but,
it definitely stirred the plot.
What you have with the, Department of Transportation cameras, and if you put enough people on it and they're, dedicated, well, you might hit something.
Sure.
And I like the little tip of the hat to Star Trek Next Generation with the FBI agent Rachel Garrity.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't resist picking out that name. I always thought that was a great name from Enterprise C. So I wanted to work that a little tip of the hat to the subcutaneous transponder, which we all learned about in Bread and Circuses, or was it Patterns of Force? I forget which Star Trek episode. But, you know, for the stuff that sticks with you when you watch enough, you know, television, you see the great writers of the day evolve, and you know, thanks to things like, you know, Amazon Prime and Hulu and everything, you can go back and see the old Twilight Zones and see the old Outer Limits, and you see these things, all, you know, the way they dealt with suspense, you can learn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You can really learn a lot. So, you know, I continue, you know, as clumsy a segue as this is, you know, I continue to write with Ray.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think his efforts to launch Starship Republic, and where I first met you guys out in Oklahoma.
Sure.
I think that's the thing that separate. Look, I look at these fan films on YouTube all the time. There are some really good ones, and there's some awkward ones. You know, what are you going to do? But I think if you lock on to what people want, the nostalgia for the TOS series, and, you know, that era and that timeline of Star Trek is a big deal. And I know Ray treats that with great reverence, and I really like the storylines he's pursuing. I'm happy to collaborate with him on it, but, you know, the reality is that that's a pretty crowded field, and you know, Starship Republic is his baby, and he's working hard on it. And you know, I hope by the time we meet again in OKC, it's much farther along as far as development goes. But you know, I think what you guys do to give a forum and an audience and a way to introduce people, you know, to an audience that would otherwise never know of them. I thought your podcast with Ray was terrific. It went 2 hours.
Yeah,
I listened to
really
all
gaffed.
Of it. Yeah, I thought it was really good.
Well, if you're willing, we can go an extra hour and we can start diving into Star Trek a little bit.
We haven't really gotten to talk about Star Trek at all yet. It's kind of a bummer.
So let's wrap up with the slug line, then we can go into another segment for Star Trek. But Don, for the slug line itself, would you give the website and ways for the audiences to get in touch with you and to purchase your book?
Oh, and before that. Thank you. We appreciate the nod. That's very nice of you to say.
Yes, true. Sorry.
No, why would
Richard's
you?
Over here looking at a timer, though.
Well, like I said, I'll always write stuff that comes to me. Right now, I'm working on a collection of short stories because just the effort to produce a novel, you know, until you've done it, you don't really know what's involved. You True. Got your great idea, and you start writing, and you got 70 pages right there, and it's taken you a day and a half, and then you just start to work because, you know, you got your fun part is out of the way now. You've shot your load, and you know, you're sitting there looking at this and saying, "Oh my God, I got to go back and dress up this character. I got to go back and do this," and you know, it is a grind, and I respect novelists like, you know, Sanford and especially Lee Child, you know, these guys that just churn this stuff out. Grisham in his day, you know, he had a couple of duds along the way, but that's because they, you know, was squeezing them for 5 books in 3 years.
Sure, yeah.
You know, when you take the money, you take the money, you know.
Right.
And, so, you know, it's that kind of thing. And I think when you really have you know, a passion for something that you want to be right, if it takes you 11 years, so what? You know, so what? It takes, you know, 21 years to raise a kid, so you're halfway there.
Right. Yeah, and I got three kids, so I might as well write at least that many books, right? I definitely appreciate that fact. You know, I've been working on a novel for going on 4 years that it's now turned into basically a series. I've worked on it with at least 20 people pretty closely, you know, and we're still going strong. Just trying to, you know, get it to the point where it's where we feel it's ready to produce, you know, like when you said that, you know, you worked at it for 6 years, a 6 year problem. I can totally relate to that because that's what I'm working on, me, a 6 year problem right now. But it is a labor of love, and I really appreciate writers, especially anyone that's willing to produce a novel, you know, without the major publishers backing. Well, yeah, without major publication backing, you know, that's good that they didn't, you know, just, you know, anyone that's actually worked on it and really cares about writing, they hold a special place in my heart because that's all I really care about, is writing. And I think that a well-written book, no matter, like, you can do something with Zach Tanner, you could never touch the character again, but because you wrote Zach Tanner, I'll always pick up Don Horan and I'll always read looking for that, because that's where the thrill is in writing. And for me, like, I'm not having fun until I'm going back and reading my finished product. So I haven't had any fun yet. But
it's funny that you pick on that you call out Zach. I think it's great that you did. But I got to tell you, some agents and not publishers, but, you know, people in the know, they who read my book when I was trying to get it published, they were like, "Well, who's the protagonist in the story?"
Duh.
who is it? Is it the girl? Is it Zach? Is it Dell? Who is it? You did a horrible job on presenting who the protagonist is. If you want to make it Zach, he doesn't show up to page 62. So how do you do that?
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing that, you know, I was criticized about is that, you know, this reads like a movie. You know, I don't like those books that take 6 pages to describe a character walking from one end of the street to the other, where he stops and looks in every window, and you talk about what he's wearing and what he had for lunch and what he's going to have for dinner, and, you know, the people walking by him, what they, you know, get to the corner, man. You know, I got very little patience for that as a reader, so I don't evoke it as a writer, but... you know, that's what they said to me, was that this has some, I'll say the word, amateurish style to it, in that your prose is rushed because you want to get to the action, and that screams screenplay, not novel. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I buy that. That's true. And it's like, how can you have a protagonist that doesn't appear till page 62? So, you know, who is the star of the show?
I think that I could very easily answer that question for him, but I'm not having to defend that, so I'm not going to. I think Richard needs to count us out, and then yeah. I got a few more things to add to that. But okay. I think we need to count out first.
Yep, real fast.
But let
me. God's sakes, we'll end on a positive note.
Yes. Well, we're going to go into two parts. I want to definitely.
Yeah, we're not done with you yet. No, sorry, Don.
You're going to stay on the line for us a little bit longer. Is that all right, Don?
That'll work for me.
Okay, we'll close it out here. And we want to give a thank you to Don Horan for coming on tonight. He's the author of Slugline. You can go to slug-line.net. And that's the website for the novel Slugline. There's a couple of different ways you can purchase it. You can get it on Amazon with the Kindle or the Nook, or you can actually get a physical copy, I believe, still as well. We want to thank Don because he was actually kind enough to loan us a book to review when we were down in Oklahoma City, and that since has been donated to our local library. So we want to say thank you for doing that for us, Don, and coming on as well tonight.
Yes,
well,
thank you, Don.
Guys.
You're welcome.
We're going to be back with a second part. We're going to talk a little bit more about Slugline, and then we're going to get into some of the Star Trek things that Don kind of alluded to. So we want to tease his mind on that a little bit more. So until the second part rolls out, we'll see everybody next time. We hope you've had fun. We've been having fun. Have a good one, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Comic Pop Library. We welcome your comments and suggestions by emailing us at admin@comicpoplibrary.com. All emails submitted become the property of Comic Pop Library and are subject for use in our show. We would also appreciate it if you would spread the word about Comic Pop Library by posting about us on Twitter, Facebook, or just tell someone about us. This podcast is not endorsed by any publisher, distributor, or studio, and it is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The views and comments of the show hosts are their own and are not reflective in any business, entity, or organization associated with ComicPopLibrary.com.